This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, November 3rd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On Monday, Robert Mueller announced the indictment of Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, and an associate, Richard Gates. He also unsealed documents revealing that one of the president's foreign policy advisors during the campaign, George Papadopoulos, has pled guilty to lying to FBI agents. Yesterday, on Capitol Hill, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan and Kevin Brady, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, released the Republican tax bill. Ryan was asked by CNN about whether the indictments would affect their plan.
I don't see it as distracting. We have Russia investigations right here. We have a Russia investigation in the House. There's a Russia investigation in the Senate. Oh, and by the way, we can walk and chew gum at the same time.
John Cassidy joins me to discuss the two issues that will be consuming Trump and Congress in coming months and how they are likely to affect the presidency and the party. Hi, John.
Hi, Dorothy.
You've been busy this week.
Every week's busy in the Trump administration.
So let's start with Mueller. It's 5 months into his investigation. He's brought his first set of criminal charges, which is pretty fast work as these investigations go. It was expected that Manafort would be indicted, but Papadopoulos was a surprise. I had to remind myself who Papadopoulos was. What message is Mueller sending?
I think he's sending the message that, you know, he's serious. The White House has been publicly, at least, trying to dismiss this investigation as sort of a shot in the dark. Mueller is sending a message both to the White House and, more importantly, I think, to other potential witnesses that they better cooperate with him or else. And the or else is, you know, you may get indicted or go to jail.
And what did we learn? Did we learn anything new about the Trump campaign's contacts with Russia? There doesn't seem to be a direct tie with Manafort.
Well, it's interesting. The Manafort stuff was all more or less expected, although it was full of lots of interesting detail about how he'd laundered money here and there. The more surprising one was the Papadopoulos, the revelation that he's cooperating with prosecutors and the details contained in the plea agreement. Now, the Trump administration, of course, said he's only a minor figure, but he has been in the room with Trump. He was mentioned as a member of the Trump Foreign Policy Advisory Board early last year. And it seems pretty clear from the court documents that he was at least trying to arrange meetings with Russian officials, including possibly a meeting between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. So that was a real sort of shot from the blue. And the White House has been trying to deal with it all week, not very effectively, I don't think.
Just to play the devil's advocate for a second here, on the face of it, is there anything legally problematic about a member of the campaign team having conversations with people affiliated with Putin's Russia?
No, I mean, not in a broad sense, because Trump was saying at the time, obviously, that he was pro-Putin, he wanted better relations. But it looks like they may have issued some lies about the particulars here, particularly Sessions, the attorney general, who was head of Trump foreign policy team, has said under oath on Capitol Hill that he didn't know anybody in the Trump campaign who had any contacts with the Russians. Well, it seems like Papadopoulos did, indirectly at least. And Trump himself, you know, now says that he didn't know Papadopoulos, even though at the time in a meeting with the Washington Post it was, I think he, you know, referred to him and said he was a great guy. So, no, nothing legally problematic, I don't think, yet, although we don't know what the contents of these meetings with the Russians were supposed to be about. Well, isn't revealing everything he's got. I think he's just sending a message here that this is a serious investigation. There are serious leads to follow up. And, you know, if we give you a call, you better cooperate.
So far, it seems, once again, it's not the crime, but the cover-up. Jeff Sessions seeming to have perjured himself, unless he truly forgot these meetings.
His version will be, this was such a minor meeting, and this guy was such a minor guy that it completely slipped my mind. But, yeah, on the face of it, he seems to have told an untruth, a lie, a perjure, whatever you want to call it. He may be called back to, and be asked about this again, and we'll see what he says.
The right-wing press has been obsessively covering the uranium story, arguing that Hillary Clinton benefited from kickbacks from Russia's nuclear industry in the early years of the Obama administration. Is there anything to that?
Well, this uranium one story has been around for years. I mean, it came out a couple of years ago with the publication of a sort of right-wing hit job on the Clintons, a book by Peter Schweitzer, Clinton Cash, And the uranium deal was originally mentioned in that. There does seem to have been contributions, big contributions, to the Clinton campaign by the Canadian firm, people associated with it, who sold the uranium to the Russians, and it was nodded through by the Obama administration. Now, on those two facts, the right wing are creating an enormous claim that this was bribery, conspiracy, and corruption. There are counterfacts. 9 different government departments signed off on the deal. The person in the State Department who signed off on it has said that Hillary Clinton herself didn't have any role in the decision. But when that became known in the campaign, the story sort of died. What's brought it back to life is another story a couple of weeks ago from The Hill, Capitol Hill newspaper. They've reported that the FBI back in 2009 discovered attempts, bribery, corruption on the part of the Russians to expand their uranium interests in the United States. It's just one report. We don't know the details of it. It doesn't seem to be linked directly at all to the, you know, Clinton campaign there. But, you know, obviously, if you're the White House, if you're the Republicans, you desperately need some sort of diversion here. So they've leapt upon that and tried to make that the story.
Well, we have another potential story here. I don't know if you've had time yet to look into the revelations in the new Donna Brazile book. She was the interim chair of the DNC, who says in the book that the party's presidential primary was rigged in favor of Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, they come fast and furious, these stories. Democrats, of course, you know, would love to be just reveling in Trump's troubles, but the fallout from the 2016 campaign keeps coming back at them. Donna Brazile, you remember, was parachuted into the DNC after the scandal about the DNC emails, which seemed to show the DNC was leaning heavily towards Hillary and against Bernie. Donna Brazile's now written a book in which she basically confirms that story, says that basically the DNC was operating as an arm of the Clinton campaign, which were, at the time was basically financing it because the DNC was broke. And she seems to have, you know, given a lot more ammunition to the Sanders supporters that indeed the fix was in as far as the DNC was concerned.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Let's move to the tax story. Paul Ryan and congressional Republicans really need to get some major legislation passed. They've put all of their remaining hopes into the tax bill.
Well, the Republican Party, of course, has had two central policies for years now. Get rid of Obamacare. They tried that. That didn't work. So they moved on to number two, which has always been tax reform, which in the Republican version of tax reform basically involves reducing the corporate tax rate from 35% to as low as possible. They've decided to lower it to 20%, and reducing various other business taxes, supposedly simplifying the tax code, and also, they claim, providing tax breaks for the middle class. Now, they've been working on this for months. They finally rolled it out this week, and Ryan and the rest of the Republicans on Capitol Hill are basically putting everything on this. They need some sort of legislative accomplishment to point to the voters next year when the 2018 midterms will take place. You know, the one thing they think they can get through and can run on is lower taxes. It's a traditional Republican message. The Democratic counter message is that this isn't really a tax cut at all. It's just a giveaway to the corporations and to big businesses. And actually, it will end up benefiting people like Donald Trump a lot more than it ends up benefiting anybody in the middle class. That, I think, is actually true. I wrote a piece about it this week. So what we're going to see now in the next couple of weeks is an enormous political battle to see whether Trump can sell this very regressive, very pro-business tax reform to his base, most of whom won't benefit from it very much at all. So it'll be fascinating to see whether he can sell that or whether the polls start going against him, even in his own, among his own voters, which is what happened in the healthcare debate.
Well, and what about the deficit hawks in Congress?
They basically only exist when the Democrats are in power. once the Republicans are in power, they go on vacation for a few years.
And now the Democrats are the deficit hawks.
And now Chuck Schumer is the deficit hawk, exactly. The Republicans are claiming that they've got a kept lid on it, but there's a lot of smoke and mirrors in the reform. And I think when we see some independent analyses, we'll see that the deficit's actually going to be blown up. But as I say, Republicans are basically saying that doesn't matter. It's much more important to get growth, jobs, etc., actually making the same arguments that Democrats make when they're in opposition. Some story is, you know, by slashing business taxes, we'll produce a big wave of business investment, productivity will leap, wages will go up, and it'll be all hunky-dory.
That was the next thing I wanted to ask you, actually. So George H.W. Bush coined the term voodoo economics in the 80s to describe this great supply-side promise. How much of this, what we know of it, borrows from that theory?
Well, it does borrow it to some extent, in that we're talking about a big cut in the corporate tax rate, which Reagan, if I remember rightly, cut the corporate tax rate from 46% to 35%. This is an even bigger cut, from 35% to 20%. Now, Reagan also slashed personal taxes a lot more than Trump is doing here. In fact, he slashed them by so much that he had to come back a year later or 2 years later and agree to a tax increase because the deficit was just exploding.
And what about the Senate? Seems exceedingly unlikely by the end of the year they're going to have a bill for the president to sign.
I think a lot depends on, you know, the politics of it all. A lot of Republicans in high tax states such as New York and New Jersey and California will be under a lot of pressure from their constituents not to support this because there are various aspects of the bill which hurt those states. They're limiting the mortgage deductibility and also limiting property tax deductions. Property taxes are huge in places like New Jersey. So as the bill stands, it's going to hurt a lot of middle class, particularly upper middle class people in these blue states, but, you know, there's a lot of red state congressmen as well. Now, I was reading some of the Democratic activists last night, and they think they only have to flip another 10 or 15 more and they can defeat this. A lot's going to depend on how the public turns on this in the last week or so. The same thing will happen in the Senate once it goes there. There'll be pressure on some moderates, you know, to try and tone it down.
And then getting back to the Russia investigations, how tangled up do you think the administration is going to be in all of this as the months go by?
I think what we learned this week is basically that the Mueller investigation is going to hang over the Trump administration for a long time, at least until the middle of next year, I would say. Some people think it might even extend beyond the midterms. Mueller is known to be a guy who doesn't hang around and would like to sort of get things finished as soon as possible. But it's only been going 5 months, and most special counsel inquiries last at least a year. Now, they brought charges very quickly, but the one set of charges from the man on the Manafort side had, you know, had been investigated even before Mueller was appointed. They appear to have moved very quickly on the Papadopoulos side. But the very fact they brought these charges, I think, indicates that they think they're not getting enough cooperation from other witnesses. This is an attempt to put pressure on people to cooperate, to flip. And they're basically building up from the outside and moving towards the center. And, of course, Trump is at the center. That's where the ultimate aim is. So I think this is not going to go away. The question is, how is the White House going to respond to it? How is Trump going to respond? And there is a big argument going on inside the White House, I think, at the moment. One faction, led by the president's lawyers, thinks that he should just stay calm, say we're still cooperating with Mueller, hope that he exonerates him, say, look, you know, it's nothing to do with us, and hope it all goes away relatively quickly. But a lot of Trump's political advisors, particularly Bannon and other media types like Sean Hannity and Roger Stone, don't think that's the right strategy. They think, you know, this is an existential threat to Trump and he needs to get more aggressive and do something about it.
Meaning firing Mueller?
The problem with firing Mueller is I think there'd be such a big outcry that Congress, even the Republicans, would probably react by appointing another special prosecutor. Although they may take a bet that the Republicans would be too supine to even do that. I think if things got desperate, they'd consider that. But I think before they go to that stage, they'll try and stymie Mueller by various ways. There's talk of, you know, reducing his funding. There's also a roundabout way of getting at him by appointing a special prosecutor on the Uranium One story and claiming that because Mueller was the FBI director when that FBI investigation into Uranium One was going on, he's part of that investigation, so he can't be a special prosecutor or special counsel on one investigation when he's under investigation himself. Sounds crazy, but John Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff, who is generally seen as one of the sort of moderate, sensible people, or that reputation has changed a bit over the last few weeks, he also endorsed the idea of appointing a special counsel to look into the Uranium One and the Russian dossier story. So it seems to be an idea that White House is at least considering quite seriously.
Thanks so much, John.
Thanks, Dorothy.
John Cassidy is a staff writer and a political columnist at NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.